Albert Einstein said, "Don't think about why you question, simply don't stop questioning." Welcome to Curated Questions. I am your host, Ken Woodward. And these questions are not mathematical equations, but rather a resource to encounter personal reflection and growth. As Tupac Shakur stated, even the genius asks questions. Now, let's engage the questioning community.
Greetings. Ken Woodward here. Welcome back to another episode of Curated Questions. Together, we engage inquisitive humans about how they use questions to navigate and make sense of our world. I'm a fellow traveler and pilgrim on this journey, and I'm glad you are here. Today's conversation is with Jenny Heglin. Jenny fosters connection and relationships wherever she lands. As a university community engagement relationship manager, golf instructor, community disaster recovery lead, or as a listening poet, Jenny pays sincere attention to those she engages. She currently has two loves. Jenny is the co-founder of Unlimited Boundaries and also serves as the executive director of the Good Listening Project. We met over a community sourdough bread-making experience led by a Bulgarian social entrepreneur several years ago, and I experienced firsthand Jenny's ability to connect. Jenny, welcome to Curated Questions.
Thank you, Ken. I feel hungry now for our conversation based on our brief greeting with each other just before we started.
Excellent. Well, I have a first question here, and I didn't even need to check ChatGPT or any other source that might figure out if plagiarism was involved, because I don't think that this string of words has ever been used before in all of humanity. All right, you ready for this?
Yes.
Okay. How does one go from life in Minnesota to founding a disaster recovery startup following a catastrophic typhoon in Saipan? Bam. How is that for a question?
That is not the question I was expecting, but I love it. Okay. Let me just feel into that for a moment.
That is a mouthful. And this is good because we're giving listeners an opportunity to unpack all of those individual words and go, I have never heard that question
okay,
before.
Okay. So bottom line is, yes, I was living and working in Rochester, Minnesota in higher education. And I moved to the island of Saipan, which is part of the U.S. Northern Mariana Islands, the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands. And how did I go about making that decision? The truth is two things. One, I was needing a change on the personal front in my personal life. I was feeling like I needed a fresh start. And my sister and her husband were living in Saipan. They were working as teachers. And my sister, Christy, was about to have her first baby. And she tempted me with the idea, what if I took a sabbatical and moved there and helped out with Lily, who was going to be their first daughter? And so needing the personal change that I did, I was leaning towards a yes. And then the more I got to learn about the island and the people and the culture and feeling into what it would be like to leave a career that I loved so much in higher education and a community that I love so much in Rochester, Minnesota, and work to kind of build those roots elsewhere, it felt right. It felt right. So I moved to Saipan, and 5 months later, after I had been living there, I started a business teaching golf or just as something to do kind of in the meantime. And 5 months in, Typhoon Sotolor hit the island, which is a catastrophic super typhoon, and destroyed hundreds, thousands really of houses and left everyone on the island. This is an island that is 5 miles by 9 miles and has a population of about 45,000 people without power and water and much communication and access to the outside world for a very long time.
Wow.
Yeah. And so the love that I have of community and for my experience with community organizing that I had built in Rochester doing social justice and other work kicked in, and the rest is history. We built two really amazing, first a response organization called United for Saipan, and then a recovery organization called CARE that ended up rebuilding hundreds of houses over the next 2 years or so that I was there.
So, wow. That is amazing. You mentioned the work or the muscle that you built mm-hmm. in Rochester mm-hmm. amongst the organizing. Mm-hmm. What does that look like? What kind of organizing did you do there?
Oh, goodness. A lot of things. Maybe I'll touch on just a couple. The first is that my role at the University of Minnesota Rochester was as the community relationship manager. So I was essentially a cultural broker between university staff and faculty and students and the rest of the community, what was going on at a more grassroots level. And UMR has a really deep commitment to community engagement and to building, to partnering with the community to create really relevant learning experiences for students. So you may have heard of service learning. This is where students do work in the community. They come back into the university and they reflect on that maybe from a theoretical standpoint. We really tried to integrate this and bring the best of what the university had to the community and the best of what the community had to the university in service of learning for our students and our faculty and staff. And so that was my formal role. And in doing that, I got involved in a lot of different advocacy efforts in Minnesota. One of them, gosh, what year was this? It would have been around, what was the second year that Obama was elected? Do you remember?
It was 2012.
2012, yeah. So yeah. there was a large campaign in Minnesota, which was called the Vote No campaign, but essentially there was an attempt to write into the Constitution a ban against gay marriage. And so this was a campaign to defeat that proposed amendment to the Constitution so that gay marriage would not be banned. And in fact, a couple of years later, there was the federal movement around it, but this was before that happened. And so that is one of the most memorable experiences that I had sort of in community grassroots organizing. And now that you're recalling this memory in me, I just got goosebumps because what was so special about this campaign was that it was a campaign built on the strategy of people having conversations with one another about love. And wow. It was so incredibly powerful. So yes, we did canvassing and door knocking and phone calling, and there were scripts, but they were there to help us have a really deeply human conversation about what does love mean to you? And for those that you love in your life, do you want them to have access to the kind of love that you have access to and sort some of the legalities and opportunities and privileges that come with that? And I mean, the nature of these conversations was so human, was so essential. It feels like I can't even remember any time in the last 6 or 7 years I've even seen a conversation like that taking place on a public stage around a political issue. And this is what we were doing in that campaign. And so, yeah, thank you for helping me remember that and how powerful that was. I think it has stayed with me and perhaps unknowingly in a lot of ways, maybe helped me navigate my choices. I don't know, but I think it did because it was so powerful. Yeah.
And so whoever had set up that structure, mm-hmm. any idea, anything about that?
Like the origin. What was the origin of that? That is an amazing question. And I don't know. I don't remember that. I wish I could remember that, but I can't at this time. And it's something that I would like to research though after this call, because I want to know now too, like where did that come from? I mean, it was probably building on something that had been done somewhere else. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting, the pedigree of, you know, who inspired that because it was so impactful.
Yes, absolutely. And so different from the nature of the conversations that are, you know, all too common, but also so fundamental. Like, what is more fundamental to all of us than wanting to be able to be loved and receive love and give love, right? Like, it's so relatable. Right. It's so human. It's something that can actually bridge rather than divide. So it was a brilliant strategy, whoever came up with it. Yeah.
It's amazing. Well, let's see if we transition a little bit to what is a listening poet?
Love it. Thank you. So a listening poet is a term that I had never heard of before I became one, and and something I never thought I would be, for sure. So a listening poet, listener poets are a concept that was created by the Good Listening Project. So the Good Listening Project is a small nonprofit that's about 5 years old that was founded by Kay McKean and Frankie Aberland just about 5.5 years ago. And the concept came from Frankie's love of listening to people. And Frankie actually would go out to the National Mall in Washington, D.C. He had been doing this for a couple of years with his typewriter and would just invite strangers over on the street, listen to them, ask them what they would like to have a poem about, listen, and then write them a poem and give it to them. And his lesson in that was that while the poem was a gift, it was really the listening that was the deeper gift. And at the time, he was working at Johns Hopkins Sibley Memorial Hospital, and his boss said, he was working in the innovation space, and his boss said, hey, why don't you come and try this in the hospital? So that is how the concept of having listener poets in hospitals and healthcare spaces was born. So what do we do more precisely? As a listener poet, I spend time with people. Usually it's about 20 to 30 minutes. And we come together for the purpose of me, the listener poet, writing that person a poem about anything that they would like. So the invitation is when we arrive in the room, there's some context setting and sort of hellos and welcoming. But after that, the invitation is, what would you like to have a poem about? And sometimes people know right away. And sometimes they're not sure. And so if they're not sure, we give them a little bit of an extra prompt, and it usually sounds something like this. Other people have found this experience most meaningful when they share about and have a poem written about something that, one, really matters to them. It's important. It's something they care about. It impacts their life. And two, it's something that is present for them. It's alive for them right now. Maybe there's something that's been on their heart or their mind that's really been traveling with them. And so with that prompt, we'll say, is there anything that comes to mind that you would like to share about? From there, the conversation goes, and the job of the listener poet is to listen and to be present. Presence is the biggest gift, I think. Earlier, we were talking about what a gift and how precious attention is. That's something you said right before we started recording. And that is what a listener poet is there to give to the person that they're listening to. And then following that conversation, what we do is we take some time to sort of let it process. We metabolize, we let it sink in what's been shared. And then as a listener poet, we craft a custom poem. And we also write a short origin story that goes along with that poem. And together we deliver those two things to the person who we wrote the poem for. So they receive those. It's theirs to keep. We also ask them if there's anything that they would like edited or changed, if we got anything wrong. Because sometimes people will say something and they'll come back and say, I know I use that word, but it actually doesn't resonate anymore. Or something in them may have shifted, right? So it's a co-creative process. It's a co-creative process. And if they would like any changes, we make those. And then from there, the poem is theirs to keep. And we also put them in anthologies for organizations or different community groups that we're working with as well. So that is what a listener poet is.
It is amazing. So we're going to dive a little deeper into this. And yes, I asked Jenny to bring along some examples of some of the work. And so letting you folks know that are listening in, you're going to get a chance to hear some of these beautifully crafted poems here shortly. But now, you started out not as the executive director. You came on staff or on as a volunteer, and you started doing this.
Yeah.
What prompted you to join in
on this task?
One of the communities and practices that has had the biggest impact on my life, my worldview, the work that I do, how I aspire to be, is called the art of hosting and harvesting conversations that matter. So the art of hosting, for short, is a couple of things. It's a global community of practice and of practitioners who are using the art of hosting in a variety of global contexts. So there's thousands and thousands of practitioners all over the globe who practice this. In addition to being a learning community, it is also a set of tools and methodologies and ways of being that we can integrate into organizations, community settings to help us have better communication, have better conversations. So I've been a part of this community for many, many years, and it's been deeply impactful on my love of questions and my desire to bring different ways of being into the workplace. Because I know it's possible and I've seen a lot of these ways through the art of hosting. But the piece that really drew me to the Good Listening Project is the harvesting part. So what is harvesting? So harvesting is the practice of making meaning and learning visible in ways that are creative and useful. So for example, you've got a group and they have a couple of days strategy session, right? You want to pull something out of that. So at the end of the day, you know, you've got fruits of that labor, right? You've got something that you can build on in the future. You're harvesting what it is that you've co-created. And so what I started doing before the Good Listening Project existed and before I knew about it was using poetry to harvest meaning and learning in my group facilitation work. So I would be listening to a circle, for example, a group of people sharing around a common purpose, and I would listen and capture elements of what each person said and then offer that back to the group in the form of a poem. So I started doing this sort of poetry as harvest in a facilitation setting. And then when I learned about it in the Good Listening Project, I was like, brilliant. This is what I've already been doing. It's listening, it's witnessing, it's showing up and being present. And then it's offering an artifact back in the form of a poem. And then that artifact lives on forever, which is also something that's really beautiful about it. I can see your wheels turning.
Well, there's so many different directions.
Yeah.
First off, I'm pleased that you obligated yourself to a 12-hour podcast so we can capture all these questions and go down all these rabbit holes. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
It'll be a bumpy ride, but we'll take breaks. What got you started into the hosting? When did this start, this curiosity, this wanting to understand, care for, engage with people? How did that start?
So I can back up from there to two different things. The way that I got connected to the art of hosting community was actually because I became a student of a field of study and a theory of change called appreciative inquiry. And appreciative inquiry is something, are you familiar with it? I'm seeing you're nodding. I'll give just a high level overview if that's useful.
Please do. Please do.
Yeah. Yep. Appreciative inquiry was created and has been built on by many others, but was created by David Cooperrider and out of Case Western Reserve University. And it's a field of practice and study that's about 40 years old. And there's entire bodies of academic research around this, as well as case studies. But essentially, appreciative inquiry invites us to flip the script on how we traditionally think about change. Rather than identifying a problem and coming up with solutions, appreciative inquiry invites us to identify what's working and to study that so that we can create more of it. And so there's a fundamental shift in the approach in terms of how we go about change. And a lot of the principles in the learning around appreciative inquiry, it has to do with our language, that our words create worlds, and it has to do with our questions, that inevitably we move in the direction of our questions. And so if we're asking questions about problems, we're going to learn more about those problems and perhaps why they exist. But that is not the same thing as creating something different or creating conditions in which that problem no longer exists. So it invites us to ask a different kind of question. For example, even if a lot is going wrong in this situation, is there a pocket of coherence? Is there a pocket of innovation where something's working? And really then trying to identify those things and dive deeper into them and understand why is that? And so it was really this shift that appreciative inquiry blew my mind at the time, because it expanded my mind so much in terms of how we could look at social change and ways we could actually try something different than what we've done in the past, because we know we need to, right? If what we've done in the past is working, then we wouldn't be where we are today. So we know we need to try something different. So appreciative inquiry is part of the set of tools and theories that is part of the broader Art of Hosting methodologies. So I got into Art of Hosting through my work in appreciative inquiry. And then going back even further, because I'm asking myself, like, what is the quest behind your question? Because it's like you keep wanting to get down to, like, where does this come from? Where does this come from?
I love you're doing all this work for me. That's beautiful. You're doing the five whys on your own. So keep up the good work.
I guess the thing I would name is that there's a couple of stories as this goes in families that parents tell. And there's one story that my mom tells a lot, which is about when I was in early middle school. We had a very long bus ride to school. It was over an hour one way. And our bus driver got a hold of my mom one time and said to my mom, "Your daughter Jenny is asking too many questions. You have to tell her to stop." Because I was annoying the bus driver. And my mom's response was, "Absolutely not. I will not tell her to stop."
I love your mom.
I love my mom too. I will not tell her to stop. And yes, it's a gift that my mom encouraged me to ask questions, but the bigger gift, I think, and this has showed up in other examples in my childhood as well, like in Sunday school, for example, at church, is my parents and my mom instilled in me that I had the right to ask questions, even if it were to an authority, or even if it were in a context where someone else had more power. And I think that is really, really incredible, because so often we don't challenge power because—
Absolutely.
Yeah. And for some people, because of their identities, it's less safe to. And so that's also part of that, the reality. But from a very early age, I learned that I had the right to ask questions of anything and anyone, including religion, which is also an establishment of authority. And my parents, Christian as they are, no matter how much I was questioning, like on a really deep level, like, what am I being taught? I was like, how do you know this is true? Like the stories of Jesus and all the things, I wasn't just going to accept this as truth. I wanted to challenge. I wanted to go deeper. And again, they let me, they encouraged it. They didn't try to keep the peace with the Sunday school teacher and the bus driver. They didn't try to just smooth things over. And I'm so grateful for that. And so I think that is one of the fundamental experiences in my upbringing that has led me to be who I am.
Yeah. Hey, your parents were a remarkable gift to you, because just being able to explore and really grow up to encounter the world around you and ask the questions such that it makes sense or doesn't in some cases. Mm-hmm. But that is a true gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely. As we said at the jump, it's unfair for me to say no. Yeah.
Well, yes. I know that our origin stories might sound different on any given day based on who we're telling it to. So I'm curious, because you obviously are so passionate about this space of curiosity and questions and seeing where it leads. And I know the values that you hold, social justice and equity. And I'm just wondering if there's anything coming up in our conversation right now that makes you think differently, or, you know, brings up anything for you about your own origin story in this quest and in this love of the work you do.
I've been told by friends that I've always questioned. And I would say, as I reflect, there's been pockets of questions. But just as you were talking about where your parents encouraged or ensured that you had a safe space to ask questions, regardless of what the topic is, I very much lived within my identities, did not question within those identities, and I stayed within the safe space within those identities. And I would not give myself permission to challenge any of that. And that's why, if we look at my identities at the high level, growing up in Northern Arizona, very conservative. My dad loved Barry Goldwater, Reagan all the way, and then evangelical Christian for 20 plus years. So that means that very GOP focused and military service. All of those are structures that served me, protected me. Those were safe places for me to be. But as you mentioned, because of the structure, there's things that you don't question. And so this is why it's been such a revolutionary thing for me over these last few years, because I gave myself permission to go and start asking those questions. And when you have someone that you teach to love your neighbor, when you have someone that you teach to go look out for the widow and those who have been incarcerated, when you say justice is good, when you say all men are created equal, when you say all of these things, you teach those as foundational. And then I learned that the lived experience in America is not that way. Then I have a choice to make. I have to either stay true to all that I have now learned and act on that, or I give in and I say, I'm going to turn my back on what I learned in those questions. I expressed it by going and walking every street and alley in DC. And I cannot, or I, it's not that I cannot, I will not go back. I am now incorporating these truths, and I'm struggling with every element of all of my identities that I've grown up with for half a century. So it's been excruciating. Another thing I found out a year ago, I have a sister that's 5 years older than me. And my Woodward name, my father, he passed away in 2010, but great conservative, Christian, moral guy, served in his community, all that's true. And it's also true that he abdicated his role as a father to my sister, who is a lovely woman. And if he had been faced with that reality prior to his passing, I know that he would have reconciled with my sister, and I'm certain of that. But all of that is true. So another piece on this is that I also had another sister who was killed in a horse accident when I was two and she was five. So I told my sister Sheila, after she found my younger sister and I, that I've had a spot for an older sister since I was two, because my older sister died. And there's been this gap of half a century where that hole for that older sister has been vacant. And so when she came into the picture, it was with my background in the social justice piece and living the truth and embracing the truth, I was absolutely going to embrace her and all that we have together in the future. That was a must. And how do I make amends for decisions our father chose? And so it's been all in. So that was yet another identity. I'm concerned about any other identities that I'm not aware of, because they're going to crumble someday in the future here. But that is how I am living all into this. This is why questions have been so critical to me and challenged me at my core. And it has been brutally painful. But on the other side, in getting to understand the truth and being able to support and amplify voices has been an absolute thing of beauty. So bring on the good questions.
Oh my gosh. Wow. What I hear you in your story, first of all, I hear these words like excruciating and brutal, which are really, you know, very deeply descriptive words of like almost agony and pain. But it sounds to me like you're also describing healing that's happening. Like these questions are almost like a pathway to your own healing, which is related to your identities and learning new information. But does that resonate for you when I say that?
Oh, it absolutely does. Aww. On the walk, there was a gentleman, Raymond Coates. Uh-huh. So he was the guy that I had the longest conversation with. I showed up walking down his alley at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And at 6:45 that evening is when I got up to leave. Oh. And he has a remarkable story. And there was no topic that was taboo in our conversation. And he kept pressing me. He was like, this is regarding the walk. He's like, what is in this for you? And I said, well, you know, I want to help change, want to help, you know, social justice, want to encourage the Black and brown community, want to challenge the white community to have these all these things, right? And he kept pressing. He's like, yeah, but what's in it for you? And he would not let that go. And he gave me the space to wrestle through. And I came to the conclusion that this was cathartic for me. Because this was my way of walking out all the white supremacy that I'd grown up with throughout all of my life and never been allowed to acknowledge or to see the effects on brother and sister humans that are around me. And so with each step and each conversation, this was a way to expunge this stuff that was deep in me. And so it was very much a healing process. And I got a long way to go, but there was 2 years and a whole bunch of hours of intentionality and deeply healing.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much for sharing that. And it's just touching me. Once again, I'm tearing up because that's what I do. But at the same time, I love this story because it illuminates that in order to heal, we need each other. Healing is not something we do in isolation. And especially when it comes to things like racial healing, we need each other. And so when you're talking about this interaction with this gentleman and what a deep impact that had on your journey and how his question was an access point for you to something so profound. And then when that shifts in you, it has ripple effects on everyone around you, right? Like, I'm saying this because I do think this is the moment in time that we are in, that what matters is starting to learn about what collective healing looks like on a communal level. And not that we're always ready and that, I mean, it's a very delicate thing, right? It's delicate and we need to protect people in that process and people have the right to protect themselves. But at the same time, what is possible in these spaces? What you're talking about, this is transformation. This is the kind of inner transformation that will absolutely affect our outer world. And in fact, without this kind of inner transformation, I would argue that we can't make the kinds of changes we need to in the world. So I love this story. And if I can also link it to one more thing, which is going back to my work at the Good Listening Project, this is what I see and feel happening in these conversations all the time, because I'm also having conversations with people who hold different identities than I do, whether that be things that are visible like race or other types of parts of our identities that may be less visible. And when we connect across these differences, something shifts on the level of the collective. And I think that, to me, that is the work worth doing in the world right now. That is it. And it's going to look different for everybody, but I think that is the work that's worth doing.
Yes. It's a common phrase of, I don't see color. To me, that is exactly missing the point. I would rather acknowledge what's true. If you're a black guy, you're a black guy. That's absolutely true. Okay, we can't deny it. But let's talk and let us give me a chance to understand and to hear the stories and to grow and learn. Mm-hmm. Because then I can appreciate as much as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. And whether it's traveling and hearing stories from other parts of the world, or I show up and now I'm the foreigner, mm-hmm. I just get a far greater understanding of the human experience when I hear other stories and appreciate them for what they are, instead of me coming in and saying, no, you don't quite see it right. Mm-hmm. But just allowing folks to be who they are and share the experiences that they've had. On the walk, I had some challenging experiences, but I've never had, it has never been for ill. Any encounter with anyone where I have, where we've been able to talk about what our differences are. Mm-hmm. There's always been goodness that's come out of it. Mm-hmm. So I'll only embrace that.
Yeah. Thank you. I feel really, what's the word? Full. This conversation feels full. You know, like a heart swell. And Angel Kyoto Williams, the Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, says, she says, love is space. She says, it's creating enough spaciousness within yourself to allow other people to be as they are. And I love that so much. And I think that's, you know, what we're cultivating in the Good Listening Project is this practice of space, people being able to hold space for others to be as they are, rather than us having this need to project our ways onto others.
What are some questions that you use to help draw people out during these listening project efforts?
Yeah. I think we find in our conversations that there's questions are absolutely powerful, and they're just such a small sliver of the connection and the field or the resonance, if you want to call it, that is created between people when they're in conversation. Even silence can be such a beautiful space of inquiry. But generally, in terms of the questions, you know, our invitation question is, what would you like to have a poem about? And the reason I love that question so much is because it meets everyone where they are, right? If someone is having the best day of their life and they want to reflect on like a deep experience of joy, they can do that. And if someone is buried in grief, they can go there. And if someone is unsure of what they would want to talk about, then they can explore that. So I love that question just in terms of meeting people where they are. And then there's a few core questions that are very basic. It's going back to the basics that we find the most powerful. One of them is not even in the form of a question. It's more of a statement, but it is, tell me more. Tell me more. Someone sharing about something and there's some, you know, maybe you want to know more about it. Just tell me more. Do you want to tell me more about that? Another question that is fundamental for us is, what was that like for you? What was that like for you when someone's talking about their experience? What was that like for you? And this is a little bit specific to our context, but perhaps I think something can be drawn out here that's relevant to a broader context is that sometimes, I don't always do this, but sometimes towards the end of a listener poet session, I'll say to someone, when you think about reading this poem, how do you want it to make you feel when you read it? Because that question invites people to name the essence of what they want the poem to hold or convey, sort of the energy of it, right? How they want to feel, the feeling. And I think so often in questions and communication, one of the most powerful strategies that I know to use is to respond to emotion with emotion. not facts and information. You know, if people are sharing something with you that has any degree of personal experience, the best way to validate what they're sharing or connect with them or learn more is to speak to and acknowledge the emotion of it, not the content of it, if that makes sense.
Hmm.
So perhaps that's, yeah, does that make sense?
What would be an example of that? So I think I understand. But yeah. What would be an example of that?
Sure. So for example, earlier when I asked you the question about your sort of what was maybe coming up and you having listened to me and some of my early experiences, and you started talking about your journey, your pilgrimage that you did in DC, talking with folks. And then I reflected something back to you. I said, so what I'm hearing you saying is that I named a couple of the words you named that were really poignant, powerful words. Excruciating, I think, was one of them. And so when I reflected back to what I was hearing, I was naming those words that pointed to really deep feelings versus, for example, I could have said, oh my gosh, Ken, so tell me, like, how did you do this walk? Like, how did you set up your mapping route? And how did you decide where to go? I could have inquired for more content. I could have inquired for more information. But because of what I reflected back and what I asked, I opened the door more to the heart. And that's where you went. And then you went down this beautiful road of talking about your own racial healing. So just as an example of even just our conversation right now, I think that was an example of doing that. Let me ask you, was that your experience of it? Does that resonate when I reflect it back?
It does. And this is where I appreciate the opportunity for deep conversations where you're giving language to that, because I hadn't considered identifying the emotion and calling it that and being intentional or strategic about, no, let's stay here with the emotion, although it may be messier, but let's stay here with that in making that container a space for that. Let's camp out here for a little bit.
Yeah. I love that.
Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I have a thought, but I think I can hold it because you were in mid-thought.
Well, we're not going to be able to go and have deep conversations and really connect without going there. Because otherwise, it stays this surface level of, great, the sky's blue and I had a great day at work. Okay, I'm done.
Yeah.
But it's only when we're able to connect and give each other a space and allow the emotions to work itself out to express.
Mm-hmm. Move.
Yes.
And that movement of emotions through the body, that is one of the definitions of healing. It's movement. Mm. Pain and trauma comes from stuckness and frozenness. So I love that you just said that because you're speaking to movement. And when emotions move through us, that's how we process stress. They got to move through. And to bring in a little bit of the neuroscience, art and poetry is one of the things that helps us process emotion. Something that I just jotted down in my notebook, which is a gift you just gave me in this conversation, is that the same thing that makes for a good poem is what makes for a good conversation. You know, if you just have a poem with some information, that is not going to touch anybody. You know, the poems that move people and touch people, they make you feel, they connect into something that you can relate to in your own human experience and that wakes something up in your emotional being and includes detail, sensory things, these specifics. As our conversation got more specific and personal, it got better. And as poems get more specific and sensory and personal and having a felt sense, they are better. So I love that insight that just emerged for me in this. Yeah.
Okay. So let's have a couple poems.
Okay, great.
And let's experience some, and we'll be able to come back to this piece. What are a couple poems you got? What's the story behind them?
Yeah. So maybe I'll share two poems that they have a very different energy. So the first one I'll share, I wrote this poem for a 13-year-old. And so we don't work with a lot of kids at the Good Listening Project. However, we do a lot of work with the VA, and they have a leadership program, a summer leadership program through one of their sites, their health clinics, their hospitals, and where they're exposing young people to different healthcare future opportunities and developing their leadership skills and such. And so, to be honest with you, some of these listening sessions with these middle schoolers, they were pretty, to use your word, excruciating. It was kind of like, you know, pulling teeth, trying to get them to say anything. And then, love being surprised, I come into this session with this 13-year-old, and this kid was just fascinating. He sounded to me like he was in his 60s, his vocabulary and his sort of view on the world. And he was just funny and like charismatic and was talking to me about his family. He was telling me about his cousins, his great grandkids, his dad. He talked about how he wanted a profession in his future where he wanted to be able to build things and be creative. So he was just talking about all kinds of stuff. And then at the end, and I wrote this in the origin story, he said to me, "I would like the poem to leave people feeling curious. It pulls people in more when things are left just a little bit unfinished." That's what he said to me.
Wow, that is an old soul.
I know. And then he says to me, and I love Jack Prelutsky. He's my favorite poet. So Jack Prelutsky is a children's poet who has written hundreds and hundreds of poems and very well known. And his poetry is, it's fun. It's got this silly humor. It's got this like rhyme, fun rhymes and speculative wordplay and all these things. So here's the poem that I wrote for this student. And Jack Prelutsky has a poem that's called "A Frog is a Frog." So this poem is inspired by that and a nod. So this poem is called "My Family is a Family." My family is a family that looks different at first, like a basket with hot dogs, hamburgers, and bratwurst. But when you look a bit closer and see who we are, we're just people, all equal, beautifully bizarre. Mom's native Cuban, dad's ancestors Japanese. The number of cousins I've got is reaching the 30s. My great-grandmother was alive when Castro took over. I'm not great with dates, but history I savor. My dad's always wanting me to learn more words. For a while, accoutrement was all that I heard. A teacher asked me one day what new words I'd learned. Disputations was my answer. This one I'd earned. I'm 13 now, so I've got a few years to go till business or prosthetics can bring in the dough. But money and titles are of little concern. Helping people is what matters. This much I've learned. I think it's best to end on a curious note and a nod to Jack Prelutsky for all that he wrote.
Lovely. Yep. And that all came out of a conversation.
Yes. And almost all of those words, I mean, all of these things were said by this student, right? He was talking about how his mom's native Cuban and Castro and history. I mean, he was talking about all of these things. I could have never written a poem like this. It's total co-creation, and it's his life. It's his story. Yep.
It's amazing. Yeah.
So
and I love that phraseology too of co-creation.
Yeah.
Because that's important.
Yeah.
Right, because it's not you just writing a poem.
Yes.
It really is co-creation. Yeah. And it's also beauty in that it is giving voice to the story of who you're sitting across from. Mm-hmm. And as you stated, it's capturing a moment.
Yeah.
Whatever it is that's on their heart, their mind at that moment.
Yeah. Yep.
That is lovely.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Yeah. Do we have time for one more, do you think?
Absolutely.
Okay. As a listener poet, I have held listening sessions with and written poems for hundreds of people in healthcare, mostly healthcare providers, some patients, some students, some caregivers. And this was a project we actually were working on with the Harvard Save Sprint, which a couple years ago was a project that was doing vaccine education across rural America. And so this POEMI, we call them, the people that we write poems for, we call them POEMIs. He worked in public health. And to this day, I have so much love for this person. So we have a course at the Good Listening Project where we teach people how to be listener poets. And after I met this person and wrote this poem for him, he decided to take our class and become a listener poet. So he now works with us, and not as much as I would like, but he's part of our community. And the 30 minutes I spent talking with him and then writing this poem was, I felt his experience so deeply, even though it wasn't mine. And it was one of really deep grief. And so one of my reflections on having done all of these poems is that I would say 60 to 70% of all the poems I write, they end up being about grief. And what that has shown me is that just we as people, there's so much that we're grieving individually and collectively, and we really need each other to help process that grief. We really do. So I'll read this poem, just a little bit of context. So this person, his daughter contracted an illness when she was 17 and died just after she was 30. So for about 13 years, she lived a really hard life, and she had 22 brain and neck operations during that time. And for each one of those operations, she got a butterfly tattoo. And this POEMI, I'll just take a minute to breathe because it's just so emotional. He talked about how he said that he used to joke with her that she was the first person he ever loved at first sight. This was his daughter. And that when she died, it really put his life into perspective, which is why he now works in healthcare. So in terms of why people go where they go, she was his reason. This poem is called Evermore. Ever pointless against tight-gripped grief, efforts to heal feel like flames on face, facing into the cannibal's cave. Every memory itself, a balm that burns, ignites hurt into harrowing pain, tries to claim father was time-bound as it chars me unchecked. Ever eager, ever clever, lover of every breath, lest ever one forgets you, a father could never. Rest fell on your journey too soon as your spirit spilled beyond, beyond that body's ability to contain what it never could. Reduced to clear, what's here is hollow, enticing as pizza, no less so than the night before. Wide-eyed child, dreamer, you outgrew this time-bound plane, flew with all 22 butterflies, each one a marking, reminding of your own remaking. Laid flat in the long barrows, still breathing, I see life anew. Live life as would you, as you guide me, starboard. Beautiful you who made me a man. Beautiful you who gave me purpose. Beautiful you who still shines light. From first sight, I love you evermore. Yeah. The things people carry, the things we all carry. Yeah.
Let's touch on grief. Because, as you state, we have all encountered a lot over the last few years. I'm aware of, just forgot her name, woman that she led an effort for planting a little white flag on the National Mall for every person that died in America. And just a collective grief. We don't know how to grieve. Sebastian Younger writes in his book about the Native American tribes, when they would come back after battle, those that went out and fought would speak to the entire tribe of their experience. And there was an opportunity for the collective to understand. We don't have anything like that. And there's no bins for us to put our sorrows into. So as you're having these conversations, I would submit you are offering a bin, some kind of a container for folks to put their grief in. So what do you think might be a helpful way for folks to process grief or work through some of the things that they may be experiencing as a result of loss or just life?
Wow, that's a big question. What I can offer is from my own experience. And the most powerful bin that I know of is community, is being able to come together with people and share heart to heart. In fact, I have someone who I wrote a poem for about 2 months ago just came to our course, and the two of us reflected together on our own experience of that. What was my experience like as her listener poet, and what was her experience as a poemee? And this person is a Black woman whose poem was about her daughter's experience with systemic racism in her school. And I'm grateful because what she said to the class was, in her full honesty, she said, I looked over and I saw that you were the listener poet. And I thought to myself, do I really want to talk to a white lady about this? And she decided that she was going to give it a try. And she sat down, and I don't actually remember doing this, but she said that I acknowledged that I was white and that she was Black, and that that wasn't lost on me in us about to have this conversation. And she told me that after that, her walls came down, and she said, it felt like our hearts were just talking to each other. And she said, it felt like we were hugging each other. We were in an exhibit hall, okay, with thousands of people. And she said, it felt like all of a sudden it mattered so much that you were white and I'm Black, until it didn't, until that all fell away and we were hugging in the middle of an exhibit hall. Now, we weren't hugging, but we were talking. But that was her, you know, her heart experience. And, you know, if that is not a practice for grief and healing, then I don't know what is. You know, and that was possible. Yes, that was the listener poet setting, but we were in community. We were in a space where we were willing to have a conversation with one another. And it was at a healthcare conference, right? So people are coming together in communities all the time. And it's just a question of, are we going where we need to go in those spaces? Or are we wasting those opportunities? Because when we're together, we have the opportunity to go wherever we want to go and create the quality of connection that we want. And I think ultimately it is connection, like remembering that we are not separate from each other, remembering that we were all part of something so much bigger, and we are not separate from each other. To me, that is the space where we can grieve and that healing can come from.
I think you just answered the question that I was going to ask next regarding loneliness, because it's stated all over the place that it's an epidemic. And by virtue of the gift of listening, being fully present, I think that that would certainly go a long way to lessening the burden of this thing that's out there, the specter of loneliness.
Yeah. I love that so much, because this is not some, like, every single one of us has the capacity to do this. to offer it to other people and to offer it to ourselves as well. It's not a matter of learning something new. It's actually a matter of reconnecting to what is our nature and what we actually already know how to do that we have been conditioned out of. That to me is so hopeful because it's like we actually don't have to change. We have to remember and reconnect to what is our nature. And even if maybe for folks who are listening, this might resonate, it might not, I don't know, but give it a try. Do an experiment. The next time you're with someone, like really give them your full attention and your presence. Maybe try what I shared earlier of like respond, really like holding and responding to the emotion of what's there, giving it some spaciousness and see what comes of that. We all have the ability to offer this to other people. And it is so beautiful when we can both offer and receive it.
What you mentioned there, both the offering and receiving, it takes humility to receive that gift. We could take it just as an action to go do. Mm-hmm. You're the primary actor here. Mm. You're the one taking action. We're all about action here in America. Mm. That's half of the equation. The other half is if the partner is willing for you to be open to receiving and taking advantage of that opportunity and receiving that healing.
Yeah. And it's a practice. My colleague Lindsay would love you because I know that would resonate with her. We're always about action. And then there's practice, which is something that I think has a different quality. Like the practice of love, the practice of listening, like these are things we have to be in all the time. If that's how we want to be, if that's how we want to exist, we have to practice it. Yeah.
Developing a practice, that sounds like a lovely thing to do, a practice of listening. Let's hear a little bit about unlimited boundaries.
I'm just reflecting on what feels relevant to share in the context of this conversation that we're having. I think that's one of the things I've become most fascinated with about questions over the years is that every question exists in a context. And it's going to be that context and the setting and the environment and the other things that are present with it, all of that affects it. And so I think what I want to share about unlimited boundaries, and maybe just a really quick story, is that unlimited boundaries is a love child of me and two dear colleagues and friends, Lindsay Keck and Ariel Goodman. And it was born of our shared sense that the way that we work together in the workplace can be different and in fact needs to be different if we're going to face the challenges of our times. All of us have worked in traditional institutions and settings, and all of us have left those settings because we want to be able to challenge and be midwifing the new, I think, rather than hospicing the old, which is, I think, unfortunately, what has to happen a lot of times when you're inside organizations. Not all the time, however. So that's what it was born from. And what we do is we help teams work better together across silos. So if you've ever worked in an organization, let me ask you this. When I say a lot of organizations are stuck in silos, what is your reaction or response?
I completely understand.
Okay. Yeah,
because we've all got our specialties. And yeah. I work for the Navy. And I am only focused on my particular project. Huh? All the other projects have no bearing on me whatsoever. And well, that's not the case, because if you go up one level in the organization, the boss has several silos within their purview. Yeah. And so let me understand or branch out and listen and understand what is going on in different groups within the organization. Yeah. And perhaps life can be better if I'm aware I may be able to help or I may be able to receive help. Yeah. And it would be easy for somebody to go, the answer is A, just stop doing the equation, move on, instead of wrestling with it for a long time.
Yeah. I love it. So yeah, everything you said is what we hear from the clients that we work with. And I think that in order to learn to work differently across these silos, or perhaps one way of thinking about it is making these silos more porous so that information can flow and collaboration can lead to new innovations and maximize impact that organizations are trying to make, we have to do something differently. We have to unlearn some things. And that takes practice. Back to the practice, it takes practice, and it also takes awareness of what are some of the habits that keep us stuck in these silos, and perhaps what are some of the habits that we engage in for good reason, because perhaps there's some competing priorities. While some of the things we do, we may not be conscious of it, but they may be protecting things that are important to us, right? And so starting to uncover and make visible some of these patterns and perhaps what's underneath them is something that we're really passionate about, the below the iceberg, right? In other words, like what we see is above the iceberg, and then all the deeper reasons for things is underneath. And at Unlimited Boundaries, what we do is we help teams engage in what's underneath and also develop the skills and capacities to be able to collaborate in new ways that can help them further their goals and break through these silos. So that's what we do. And a quick story that I'll share that is related to questions, even just so just this morning, I was meeting with Ariel and Lindsay, and we're doing some work with the Air Force, actually. And we were talking about a project that we're working on and a workshop that we've got coming up. But we always have a check-in. That's one of our practices, is when we come together and to get grounded, we always do a check-in. Earlier in the week, I had had a conversation with Lindsay. And Lindsay has been frustrated with kind of her own relationship to time. And so she's been saying a lot like, there's never enough time. Why do I never have enough time? There's never enough time for things. And in that conversation, I said to her, I was like, Linz, what if we flip this on its head? What if time is all we have? And I just left it at that, right? So I asked, I was trying to flip it because she was stuck and she was saying she felt stuck. And so I thought, well, how do you get out of stuckness? Maybe try flipping it. So anyway, we come in the check-in today and Lindsay's like, Ariel, there's this question that has been working on me all week. You're not going to believe this question. It blows my mind. She's like, you know, this is what Jenny and I were talking about. And Jenny said, you know, what if time is all we have? And Lindsay's like wide-eyed looking at Ariel, waiting for this reaction. And Ariel's like looking at her like, what? Like this face. And Lindsay's over here mind blown. And what Ariel said to her was, she's like, Lindsay, what's more interesting to me is like the way you're relating to this question, and why did it have so much impact on you? You know, and why is it affecting you in this way? And Lindsay said, well, when I thought about it in that way, like if time is all we have, all of a sudden it's completely an abundance. It shifts my mindset from seeing it as a complete abundance rather than the scarcity, the way I was relating to it, right? And so awesome, that question was transformational maybe, or at least impactful for Lindsay in that moment. But Ariel was not part of that conversation, was not part of that context. It didn't do anything for her. The point of my story here is just that questions are interesting and fascinating, and the words matter. The shift of one little word can matter. And it's also about everything else that's happening in a space, energy, the particular people, and the context, really. So yeah, that's a little bit about Unlimited Boundaries and a little story to give you some insight into who we are as a team.
Gotcha. And you tied in the question there beautifully, and I completely agree that as much as I mentioned this on a previous episode, where as much as I try to craft the perfect question, oftentimes it is just the basic question, but it's the tone and the care that backs it up that can really carry a lot of weight or meaning associated with that. Yeah. But that is a great question or great concept, though, of flipping it and asking the opposite amidst all the felt chaos at the moment. Yeah. So love that strategy.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you. And you're speaking to the quality, right? Like the qualities of the question and the space. And so I love that, because at the Good Listening Project, we say, one of the things we love to say is that the quality of someone's listening determines the quality of someone speaking or someone sharing. And I think that's actually really profound because, again, it gets to the co-creative nature of all of this. You know, this isn't transactional. Listening and communicating and understanding, it's not transactional, it's relational. So yeah, the quality of your listening can actually impact the quality of my speaking. And it did today, actually. I can feel it. So thank you.
Absolutely. Another concept, broad concept, but I wonder if you've mentioned it, is silence and the use of silence strategically. Can you talk about that?
I'm just laughing at this silent pause as I'm reflecting on this question.
It's absolutely, arguably for effect, if you hadn't paused, I would probably inject a big pause into the audio just for the impact. So you're welcome, all. Okay.
There's so many directions here, but I think the thing that I'll point to perhaps is that silence is one of the most powerful places from which true emergence and breakthroughs can come from, in my experience. So what do I mean by that? Silence is a gift because when we can be in silence with other people, whether it's one-on-one or others, something in the mysterious realm is at work. And I think I'll just tie it back to the grieving and the healing. I think mystery and the embrace of mystery plays a role in that as well. So in silence, something in the mysterious realm is at work. And when we give the gift of silence to ourselves and to others, I think so often I've seen surprise come from that space. People will be able to tap into something that maybe they haven't ever been able to before. There's a thing you can see that happens in listener poet sessions where when you give silence and then when someone starts to share after that, you can almost see that they're saying something that they've never said before. And in that, it's like the silence has helped them access something. And you as the listener and having offered that silence as a gift have helped them access something that is probably wisdom already inside of them, just needing sort of an access point or a doorway perhaps to come through. So I'm not sure if this is what you were expecting or thinking I would go with this question, but that is what came up for me.
I was on board with whatever came.
Okay.
I was not going to try to push you in any particular way. I was counting completely on you being you and delivering your experience, which you did. So thank you.
Yeah, you got it.
Yes. All right. As we look towards wrapping up here, mm-hmm. Do you have any other thoughts or encouragements about questions, how they might be used, anything that was you were preparing to come into this conversation that we haven't had a chance to touch on?
This is what I do when I'm deep in thought. I have to look out the window and get a broader perspective. So
that works.
Taking a moment to look out the window. There's a very short poem by Mark Nepo that maybe I'll just share because it feels alive for me in this moment. And I love it so much. It goes like this. If I dare to hear you, I will feel you like the sun and grow in your direction. If I dare to hear you, I will feel you like the sun and grow in your direction.
Beautiful. Okay. I'm full. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
Yeah. Maybe even stuffed, but in a good way, hopefully.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. All right, Jenny, where is the best place for folks to engage with you, learn more about what you're excited about, or to connect with you?
Yeah. If you want to email me, you can email me at jenny@unlimitedboundaries.co. And if you want to learn about any of the work that I'm engaged with, the Good Listening Project is just goodlistening.org. And Unlimited Boundaries is unlimitedboundaries.co. And so those are the websites. And I would love to connect with people on LinkedIn. And if anything really resonated or moved something in someone who's listening, what a delight it would be to hear from someone. That would be a surprise and a delight. So I say that as an invitation for people to be in touch if anyone feels called.
Thank you. I'll also share those in the show notes as well. Jenny, thank you for sharing your experience with both questions and listening and how they can be a healing force in this complicated and sometimes harsh world. For those who have joined us through the magic of technology, thank you for being here. Questions changed my life for the better, and Jenny shared examples of the sound of listening and intentional caring and how she has deployed her life to serve others in sometimes unique ways. As you exercise your question expertise, consider employing the listening ideas that popped into your mind while listening. It will make a difference. Please take all that you have learned here and be a light to those around you. Gratitude shout out to Beauty Pill for the show's music and producer Ben Ford for the technical help. This episode was recorded on Piscataway land. And please engage with this episode in some manner. Download, follow, save, like, or share, or comment about something that resonated. So until next time, keep questioning.